I think as Bible students, we are very familiar with the events that lead up to and culminate with Jesus' death upon the cross. One of the passages that present one of the last scenes of the cross is John chapter 19, verses 25 through 27, that tells us that Mary, but standing by the cross of Jesus, were his mother and his mother's sister, Mary, the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. And when Jesus then saw his mother and the disciples whom he loved standing nearby, he said to his mother, "Woman, behold your son." And then he said to the disciple, "Behold your mother." And from that hour, the disciple took her into his own household. We realize that the events that culminated in that, particularly the events of the night before, were a series of both highs and lows. The highs were of a spiritual nature. Jesus and his disciples had assembled together to observe the Passover feast, as was a part of the law of Moses. But we as Christians know that Jesus used that occasion to institute the Lord's Supper, which we will observe together in just a few minutes. Often lost in that because we tend to go and focus on some of the failures that I'll talk about in just a minute. We often miss the fact that in Matthew 26 and verse 35, there was a tremendous unifying moment where all of the disciples pledged to Jesus that they would rather die with him than deny him. I think we miss that sometimes because we go right to Peter's denial and that. But the fact of the matter is they all said that. And at the moment that that was said, I think we would realize that that would have been a very positive thing to be in that and with them at that time as they in unity professed their commitment to the Lord. But of course, those highs were followed by and accompanied by a number of lows. And while the highs were of a great spiritual nature, the lows definitely demonstrated to us the failure of human beings. There was the internal squabbling that we're told in the very beginning of those passages between the disciples themselves as to which one of them was going to be the greatest. Luke describes that to us in Luke chapter 22. Then there was the treachery of Judas when he left from that supper on his way to do what he had planned and bargained to do, and that is to betray the Lord. There was the failure of the disciples in the garden after they left from the meal and Jesus took them to the Garden of Gethsemane. He asked them to watch with him while he went on to pray, and they failed to do that. They fell asleep. And then, as the arrest occurs and the events that follow the arrest, we know Peter's denial of Jesus and then ultimately the trial and its results. So, we look at that, and the fact of the matter is that the narrative of the Gospels does not follow most of the disciples. All we know about them is when the events transpired in the garden and the mob led by the priest officers took Jesus away, that we are told that all of them fled. But not all of them are omitted from what is said in the Gospels. We know what happened with three of the 12. We know, of course, about Judas. Matthew 27, verses 1 through 10 tells us that he regretted what he was doing, that he tried to return the money to the priests, and they basically just ignored him, and he went out, and in his grief and sorrow, he hung himself. We all know about Peter, because we spend a lot of time talking about Peter and his failures. We know the Gospels, and particularly Matthew 26, verses 69 to 75, tells us in detail the fact that Peter did indeed fulfill what Jesus said about him when he said, "You're going to deny me three times before the rooster crows." And so we're familiar with Peter's failure. It is the action of that third disciple, the one that in his own gospel, John never refers to himself by name. He simply refers to himself as another disciple. It is him that is interesting, and it's the point of this study. Because in the text that we read at the very beginning, we see that of the 12, he is the one that is specifically mentioned, even though I believe he fled, because it says they all fled, that he quickly recovered and followed after Jesus, followed through the trial and was there at the cross when Jesus died. And so it's that third disciple that often gets overlooked. We're told in John 18 and verse 15 that he was known by the high priest, and that he actually gained entrance into the courtyard of the high priest when Jesus was taken there. And not only did he gain entrance for himself, he is the one that got Peter entrance into that courtyard. John 18 and beginning of verse 15. Simon Peter was following Jesus, and so was another disciple. Now that disciple was known to the high priest and entered with Jesus into the court of the high priest. But Peter was standing at the door outside, so the other disciple, who was known to the high priest, went out and spoke to the doorkeeper and brought Peter in. And so this other disciple that we understand is John. He was there throughout the period of the trial and the ultimate conviction that was given that Jesus was to be taken and executed by the Roman soldiers. And of course, we've already read the passage as the opening of those who were at the cross, at least in the near vicinity of the cross. We don't know how many people were standing far off, and I would say that we don't know whether some of the other disciples might have been farther out in the distant crowd. We're not told anything about that. But we are told that Jesus is on the cross and that John is close enough that Jesus can speak to him. And so he is there because of this passage we've read where he commits the care of his mother into John. At this time, Jesus' brothers may not have yet declared their discipleship. We know that as the ministry of Jesus went on, that his brothers were not always supportive of what he did, or at least in some ways challenged it. There's no doubt that by the time we get to the book of Acts, perhaps because of his resurrection, James and Jude are now disciples, and James, his brother, becomes a leader in the Jerusalem church. But at this time, they're not mentioned as being present, and we do not know where they stand. Jesus is dying, but he has not been buried. He has not yet risen from the dead, which would prove that he truly was the Son of God. So Jesus commits the care for his mother into the hand of the disciple that's standing there. And so we recognize that. So the question that really brought up in my mind the development of this lesson is, so what was there about John that would have prompted him to be at the cross in the very near proximity of the cross when the other disciples were either not there at all or they were much farther away, maybe having recovered themselves from their initial fear when they fled? And I understand that we cannot know that for sure, because there's no clear passage of Scripture that says this is why John was at the cross. But the point of the lesson is that there are things that we are told in the Gospels about John that inform us more about him and can lead us to understand why he would have been there, and what there was about him that would have caused him to brave the crowd and brave the priesthood and their people that were wanting to put Jesus to death. What we do know, first of all, is that he was one of the first of the disciples chosen by Jesus. In the book of Mark, in the first chapter, Mark tells of the calling of the apostles. And the first set that are called are two brothers that are fishermen, Peter and Andrew. But we're told in Mark 1, beginning in verse 19, that going on a little farther, that's a little farther from where Jesus had called Peter and Andrew, he saw the sons, James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother, who were also in the boat mending the nets. They also were fishermen on the Sea of Galilee. And immediately he called them, and they left their father Zebedee in the boat with the hired servants, and they went away to follow him. So very early in the ministry of Jesus, a relationship develops with James and John. There are those that believe that James and John were probably cousins of Jesus. Many scholars suggest that possibility. It's based upon a comparison of the two accounts in the Gospels of those who are gathered at the cross. Matthew 27:56 says, among them was Mary Magdalene, and Mary the mother of James and Joseph, and the mother of the sons of Zebedee. Whereas John's account, which we've already read, says standing at the cross were his mother and his mother's sister and Mary the wife of Clopas and Mary the Magdalene. So many at least conclude that the mother of the sons of Zebedee was Mary's sister. Again, I don't know how conclusive that is, but it's a real possibility. We know that, and we'll talk about this in just a minute, that their mother felt close enough to Jesus himself that she could approach him, as we'll talk about in just a moment. But whether James and John were actually related to Jesus or not, what we can tell for certain from the Gospels is that they were among the inner group, the closest group of his disciples, his apostles. You know, the way we have to understand this is there was a large group of disciples. We think about the 12 apostles. Jesus did select that 12. But you know, there was also another group of 70 that did not include the 12 that he sent out to preach through the kingdom of Judah. And there was a large number. Paul mentions in 1 Corinthians that shortly after his resurrection, he appeared to 500 brethren at one time. And so during the ministry of Jesus, he had a larger group, but there were also these smaller groups that he utilized. And we know the 12 apostles, we think about them, but we also know that Peter, Andrew, James, and John were often selected by Jesus and separated from the other of the 12 apostles to do special things with him or to see more than the others had seen. We know James and John, the brothers, had somewhat of a unique personality. This caused Jesus to give them a nickname. When the Mark lists the 12 apostles, in Mark 3:17 he says, and James the son of Zebedee, and John the brother of James, and to them he gave the name Boanerges, which means sons of thunder. So if you look at that and somebody says, these are the thunderbolts, that would tell you that they were aggressive and outgoing, and that they were selected by Jesus to do some things with him when he did not take the entire 12 with them. And there's evidence of that throughout the gospel accounts. Just a couple of them we'll mention in just a minute. But in regard to this nature of these men, before we go any further, you see that demonstrated in the gospels. In Luke chapter 9 and verse 49, we're told that John answered and said, he's having, Jesus having a discussion with his disciples, his apostles. Master, we saw someone casting out demons in your name, and we tried to prevent him because he does not follow along with us. You see that personality coming out. We saw this fella, and he's not with us, and he's claiming to be with you, so we tried to take action about that. And then again, in Luke 9, as the story is given, as Jesus and the apostles are traveling to Jerusalem for what will be the final week of his life, they travel through Samaria, and the apostles try to make arrangements for Jesus to have a place to stay, to rest, to eat, or whatever on that journey. And this town rejects them. And we're not even told which of the town of the Samaritans it is. But in Luke 9 and verse 54, it says, when the disciples, James and John, saw that the people weren't accepting Jesus, they said, Lord, do you want us to command fire to come down from heaven and consume them? Let us take care of that. You've given us these miraculous powers, and they won't receive you. We can take care of them. So that kind of gives us a picture as to what James and John were like. And whether it's the result of the familial relationships, whether they were exactly his cousins or not, we know that with their personalities that James and John desired to be leaders among the disciples. We know that their mother had those aspirations. In Matthew chapter 20, verses 20 and 21, it says, then the mother of the sons of Zebedee came to Jesus with her sons, and bowing down and making a request of him, and he said to her, what do you wish? And she said to him, command that in your kingdom these two sons of mine may sit one on your right and one on your left. So their mother had those aspirations for them. But Mark indicates in his account, Mark 10 verses 37 and 38, that she instilled that within them, because in Mark records that they say to Jesus on another occasion, grant that we may sit one on your right and one on your left in your glory. But Jesus said to them, you do not know what you're asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink or be baptized with the baptism with which I am baptized? And they affirmed that they could. But he told them, it's not mine to give you those positions. But the fact is, this shows us their nature. And undoubtedly, as we observed about the negative aspects, the lows of the night in which he was betrayed, this probably contributed a great deal to that contention among the disciples, because the indication we get is the others did not appreciate James and John pushing for a position of leadership above them. So, we know this about them. But what we also know is that the Gospels clearly show us that James and John, along with Peter and sometimes Andrew, were in times selected from among the rest of the apostles to be with Jesus on some important occasions. Of course, the focus of this lesson is on John and what would have gotten him to the cross. And so the point of this is just that relationship was there. And a couple of examples of that. In Luke 8 and verse 51, Jesus is approached by a synagogue official whose daughter had died. And we're told in Luke 8 and verse 51 that Jesus, along with those who were accompanying him, came to the house. But it says when he came to the house, he did not allow anyone to enter with him except Peter, John, and James, and the girl's father and mother. So no matter who else was following Jesus at that time, only Peter, James, and John were allowed to go with him, along with the parents of the girl, into the house where he raised her from the dead. We also know that in the transfiguration accounts in the various Gospels, Mark 9 and verse 2 says, 6 days later, Jesus took with him Peter, James, and John, and brought them up on a high mountain themselves, and he was transfigured before them. So only these three, and John was among them, were allowed to be present when Jesus was transfigured, when they got to see Him not in His fleshly state, but in His divine state. When God revealed to them and affirmed to them by the transfiguration that He was indeed deity and had the glory of God in His presence. Another interesting one is that when we talk about that night of His betrayal and talk about what we often call the Last Supper, Luke 22 and verse 8 says, "And Jesus sent Peter and John, saying, 'You go and prepare the Passover for us that we may eat it.'" So only Peter and John were sent ahead to prepare the upper room and to make everything ready for that momentous night. And then finally, we have affirmed in Scripture that there was a very close relationship between John and Jesus. John 13 and verse 23, as John accounts the Last Supper, he says, "There was reclining on Jesus' bosom one of His disciples whom Jesus loved." Now, I don't think we should make more of this than is there. It doesn't mean that John was the only disciple that Jesus loved, because we know that Jesus demonstrated love for all and for all of His disciples. But it does record, and it does use the Greek word agapo, a form of it in this passage, that of this very highest of reverential type of love, of commitment and service, and it says that Jesus loved him. And so the thing that I would get out of this is that John knew that Jesus loved him, and there was obviously a relationship there. If nothing else, it indicated that at the supper, as the 12 of them were around the table, John was the one who was seated closest to him. So John understood and knew that Jesus loved him. And so my only point about that is that the depth of that relationship with Jesus could have contributed to John himself overcoming his fears on that night that would have caused him to originally flee, and that the loyalty that he felt for him would have motivated him to follow Jesus not only through the trials, to be recognized with him. I mean, we have to understand that when it says that he was known by the high priest knew who John was and knew who he was with, and that didn't bother John at that moment, even though Jesus had been arrested and they were in the process of trying to arrange for Jesus' death upon the cross. And so that would have motivated John to be there and to follow and to carry it on through. Great love motivates people to do very difficult things, and all of us have seen that demonstrated among human beings, where it is the devoted love of a husband or a wife that causes them to loyally stand with their mate while they are ill or while they're dying. The love of a mother who attends to a child that is dying. The love of a best friend. You know, not too long ago, just a few days ago, gospel preacher that I only know casually passed away from cancer. But the thing that kind of let me know that things were getting very serious was that two people from Cincinnati that had been his college friends, they posted on Facebook that they had traveled to Houston to spend a couple days with him. That's what friends do, is when someone's told they don't have very much time left, they've meant something to me, I'm going to do whatever I have to do, take off from work, leave my family behind, I'm going to go spend that time. And so I don't think it's that difficult to come to the conclusion that that kind of relationship between Jesus and John was the reason why he was at the cross, close enough to the cross, for Jesus to speak to him and for Jesus to commit the care of his mother to him. But one other thought, and that is the fact that when we look at John, John was probably the last of the disciples, at least in that close of contact, to see Jesus alive. That conversation that we read at the very beginning of this lesson happened just prior to Jesus breathing his last breath. So John is in that unique position that he was probably one of the, if not the very last of the 12 to see Jesus before he died. He was also among the very first to be a witness of the resurrected Jesus. We're told in John chapter 20 that Mary Magdalene had gone to the tomb. You know the story. They were going to prepare. Jesus had died on the day before the Passover. You couldn't. You had to be cleansed ceremonially by sunset in order to observe the high holy day. So they took Jesus and put him in a tomb. Then they observed the Sabbath. They observed the Passover. On the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene, among others, comes, and they're going to now prepare Jesus' body for its permanent burial, and they find the tomb empty. We all know that story. John 20 and verse 2 says, "So she ran and came to Simon Peter and the other disciple whom Jesus loved and said to them, 'They have taken away the Lord out of the tomb, and we do not know where they have laid him.'" So Peter and John investigate that themselves. In John 20 and verse 8 it says that the other disciple who had first come to the tomb, the previous verses say John got to the tomb first, but he was just looking in. Peter ran by him and went on into the tomb. And verse 20 and verse 8 says, "He also entered, he saw, and he believed Jesus had been raised from the dead." So that's the path of John to the cross. So what do we make of all that? Well, there's an interesting observation, I think. We know that this group of Jesus' closest disciples played a very important role in the history of the early church. You have James and John, the two brothers, who said, we're willing to be baptized with the baptism that you're baptized with. We want to be at your right hand and at your left hand. And those brothers are a very unique situation, because James becomes the first of the 12 apostles to be martyred in the cause of Christ. Herod puts him to death in Acts chapter 12. So he suffers some of what Jesus suffered and becomes the first of the martyrs, of the apostles. And then John is the last of the 12 to die. John lives to an old age. He's imprisoned on the Isle of Patmos. And the Bible doesn't tell us of his death, but the human traditions, somewhere in his late 90s, he dies. All the other apostles, including Paul and other important leaders like Barnabas and those, and even James, the brother of Jesus, have all died, and John is the last one to go. We know that Peter has such an important role in the establishment of the church, and particularly is the focal point of the first half of the book of Acts. So John, he's a member of the 12 apostles. He's influential in the church at Jerusalem. He's involved in Acts 15 when it's the discussion over what Gentiles need to do in order to be accepted into the church. And then by human history, we are told that in his later life, he was a leader in the church at Ephesus until he died. So that's the story. I have no other real point other than that. The one application I would make is that John is our example that you do not have to be a martyr to be a servant of Jesus Christ. We honor those from Stephen on who've given their lives and whose lives have been taken from them because they stood. And certainly those are worthy examples, and we should be willing to do that if we are called upon to do that. That should be the strength of our faith. But we should also recognize that a person can live to a ripe old age. Even one of the apostles did. But he never turned back on the service that began when he was one of the 12. And he lived his entire life as a faithful servant of Jesus Christ. And there, that is a worthy example for any of us who want to wear the name Christian. That you can live your entire life in service and die faithfully at a good old age. So there's John and his story and why he got to the cross and what he did after the cross is our great example. So we're going to conclude. We don't know what's in the hearts of any individual that's here this morning. I assume that most of us are members of the church, but there may be some here who have never obeyed the gospel this morning, who have been given that consideration, and Roger's going to lead the song for us, and that invitation is yours. If you want to put in action your discipleship by naming Christ this morning, you can confess your faith in Him, you'll be baptized in His name for the remission of your sins, and then you can begin your life of service. So if you're interested in that, we want you to come while we stand, while we sing.